Hello, I'm Summer.
I'm Michelle.
And this is the I've Read That podcast. We back.
We are back. Episode 2, baby.
Yeah, baby. yep, go ahead.
I was about to say this week. This is not a weekly podcast.
No. This, more like monthly.
This time, we are discussing The Secret Garden by Frances Hodgson Burnett.
Yes, yes, yes. And I don't know how we want to start out, but I do have some background information on her that might kind of put into maybe a little bit of context some of the the book. And this is from the Encyclopedia Britannica, so I'm hoping it's accurate.
One would hope.
Yeah, right? So she was born in 1849 in Manchester, and she died in 1942. So born in 1849. In 1854, her father died. Okay. About 9 years later, they moved to Knoxville, Tennessee from Manchester with the promise of some, like, of success from her maternal uncle. But that never actually happened. Figures. So, yeah. So she started off like a child and then not... Well, I guess she was...
As many of us do.
She was still young. She was like 15 and her father died.
Yeah.
So she was very young when her father died and then poor and moved to the U.S. for prospect and nothing came of it. She was married in 1873 and got divorced in 1898. But during that time, she was published in a lot of papers and monthly magazines. And she, over her lifetime, wrote over 40 novels and many, many plays. She was a successful playwright. And commonly what she portrays are... She has very, very realistic details in her book. And she portrays the working... Like, normally working class life. So in Secret Garden, she portrays... more of like an upper class life, but she does go into some detail about working class characters.
Right.
Most of the characters are working class, with only like a handful being the upper class. But yeah, that's kind of just like a little tiny background. I figured I'd bring that in to help with a little bit of context.
Yeah, that's good. You know, it's funny because I was looking through my notes from school because I actually read this for one of my children's lit classes, and I was like, oh, I must have all these notes. I must have taken such diligent notes. And then I had almost nothing written down. But I did remember that this book was originally serialized from 1910 to 1911, and then it was finally compiled and published in 1911. And the other thing I think that would be good to kind of note is that it's sort of sitting in this tradition at the time of having quote-unquote girls' fiction or these coming-of-age stories for girls like Heidi or Anne of Green Gables, right? We're all kind of published... within 30, 40 years of each other. So, should we start with a summary?
Yeah, I think, and we kind of briefly texted each other about this already, but we think that the summary for this one is going to go by a lot quicker than Holes. Holes had a lot of details in it. Hope you guys listened to our first episode. The Secret Garden.
It's a longer book and
yes,
a more complex writing style because it's older, but the plot is a lot more straightforward.
Very simple. Do you want to dig into it? Not like holes, yeah, but like, you know, like digging in a garden.
I was like, I'll just read what's on the back of my book, but I have the Norton Critical Edition, so it doesn't actually summarize.
Do you want me to
yeah, go for it.
My back? Okay. Mary is an unhappy orphan forced to live in the home of a wealthy guardian, a busy man who has no time at all for her. But when Mary meets her guardian's mysterious son and discovers a secret garden hidden on the estate, a startling change begins to overcome or to come over her. And life for everyone is never quite the same. So
I think a lot of plot summaries could end with that sentence.
Yeah. That's like a really rough and tumble way of summarizing it. There are more details than that, let me put it that way.
Right.
Do you want to start out like with the beginning? Because that's kind of for Mary's character. The beginning kind of gives context for...
Yeah, and this book has quite a startling beginning, I think. Yeah. Especially yeah. for a contemporary reader. I have the unabridged version. I think you probably Same. Have an unabridged version.
Yep.
Mine's
the Watermill Classic, complete and unabridged.
Yeah. And I think it's not very common anymore for kids to read the unabridged version. I think as a kid, I probably read the Children's Illustrated Classic
yep.
version That's with the white too. Cover. And those are all very heavily abridged. And so, you know, opening this up and beginning with, first of all, the description of Mary as an incredibly ugly child.
The most disagreeable looking child ever seen.
It was true, too.
Yeah, that's...
And it goes on and on about how kind of sickly and ugly and also, selfish. It calls her tyrannical.
Mm-hmm.
So just kind of all around a pretty garbo child.
Yeah. I wrote down in my book, no wonder she's angry. Everyone calls her ugly.
And then, so that's what I would call probably the first startling thing about the first chapter. The second is that we begin in British-occupied India, which is... You know, historically, a thing that happened, and there were British children born in India. But it strikes me as so odd to see it in a children's book, and I don't know why, because this was written when that would have been pretty relevant and not particularly startling, I think, to its contemporaries. And I think the third thing that strikes me about the opening chapter is the fact that everyone dies.
Yes.
And Mary is completely forgotten and abandoned. And probably would have starved to death if she wasn't found.
They just forget her in, like, a hut or something. Yeah. Like she's just, like, left in a hut. Or bungalow. Sorry, a bungalow.
So
with a snake.
Yeah. So it's a pretty... It's a pretty bold way to open, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of very tonally different from, I would say, at least the latter two-thirds of the book.
Yeah.
I mean, the place that we start and the place that we end in this book is very, very different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Mary... After her family has died and everybody basically, not just her, well, she had a very, like, non-existent relationship with her mother and father, and she was raised by servants,
mm-hmm.
Native servants, and even then she was, like, really mean to them and, like, didn't even learn how to dress herself, like, didn't bother how to dress herself because she didn't have to, but everybody dies of, is it yellow fever? Oh, cholera.
Cholera.
Everybody dies of cholera. Yes. One of the lines, that kind of I underlined, I was like, she did not cry because her nurse had died. She was not an affectionate child and had never cared much for anyone, which is so, like, so terrible to think about and hard to read. This, like, this poor child, like, didn't get any love and, like, wasn't treated the correct way. Like, with the correct warmth, that she's just like, oh, I don't care that this person who's taking care of me has died because I don't have a connection to them. And then something else that it's, like, very, very shortly after, this is on page 5, but very shortly after it says, like, The noise and hurrying about and wailing over the cholera had frightened her, and she had been angry because no one seemed to remember that she was alive. So that's kind of what you were talking about, where she's just completely forgotten about, which stinks. And it kind of, that actually, something I didn't think about is that harkens to later in the novel when Mary finds out, like discovers Colin.
Mm-hmm.
That it's like Mary's alone and has to take this journey to kind of find herself and find people who care about her.
Mm-hmm.
And like when she finds Colin, Colin's alone and he's alone in the room.
Yeah.
And he has no one. So that kind of does connect.
Yeah. So Colin, who is her cousin.
Yes.
Who essentially is alone all the time except for his nurse who waits on him. But his father, Mary's uncle, really doesn't pay any attention to him at all. And so this kid is just completely socially deprived and just, like, riddled with anxiety.
Like, makes himself sick with it.
Yeah.
And doesn't know how to get out of it.
And I think you're right, because in that serves as a really good kind of signpost to see how much Mary has changed by the time that she discovers him, because at the beginning of their own journeys, these are two very similar children.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time that Mary meets Colin, which is it like halfway through the book?
Kind of, sort of. Because she's only been there a couple months at that point. Maybe like, or like a month and a half or 2 months or something. I don't even know. Yeah, but it's a significant distance in, because I feel like, let me see, The Young Raja, chapter 14,
mm-hmm.
So like the middle of the book, like 128, and that's like after she meets him.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's like, I guess, like you're like the last 3/4 of the book, so I guess it is a lot of it. Like chapter 13 is I Am Colin, is what it's called. So out of how many chapters? It's 27 chapters. It's chapter 13.
Yeah,
so
just about half.
Yeah. So I guess just to do... So Michelle mentioned her... Mary Lennox is the main character.
Mm-hmm.
Her uncle. He is...
Mr. Craven.
Yeah. He is said to have, like, a hunchback. And he does. And he has, like, a back problem. Mm-hmm. And... he doesn't pay much mind to Colin because Colin's mother died when he was born.
Mm-hmm.
She was injured and then died when he was born. So Mary gets there and she stays inside for a while. She won't eat anything. She's still sick. And then she's so bored to the point where she's just like, well, I guess I'll go outside. And when she first saw the moor, like at night, she's like, this is dreadful and ugly and I hate it. And then she decides she'll go outside, and she has another like maid who looks after her, Martha. And she does actually play an important role. Actually, more the characters, like her relatives, play a big role in Mary's life.
Yeah.
But
I think that
as well,
kind of the most important thing about Martha is that she kind of steps in to fill this servant role for Mary, but she stands up to Mary a little bit, and it makes Mary realize that she doesn't have as much authority as she thought she did.
Yeah, it kind of puts her in her place.
Yeah.
Which is also what Mary does to Colin later, when nobody else can.
Tough love.
So Mary goes outside, she starts to explore, and she meets some of the gardeners. Mm-hmm. Ben Weatherstaff. So she meets him.
She meets the Robin.
She meets the Robin, yes. It's a Ben Weatherstaff's friend, the Robin. So she hears about this rumor from Martha about how there was a garden that Mrs. Craven had.
Mm-hmm.
It had roses. It was a beautiful garden. It was like enclosed in walls, and there was a door that would lock. And then when she died, the key was buried, and everybody was told you can't enter the garden anymore. Like, it's completely shut off. You can't go in. So that's the whole plot. The whole point of, like, the secret garden. So when Mary hears about this, she becomes intrigued. And that kind of gets her interested in, like, walking around more and trying to figure out this mystery.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the mystery that kind of kicks all of that off.
Yeah.
And
I think a lot of it is her just being really obstinate, and she wants to find this thing that no one else is allowed to find.
Yeah. Yeah. And it would be, like, a place of her own, too. Like, if nobody's been there, it's kind of like she can reclaim it as her own, and she's never really had anything that's her own.
Yeah.
So she obviously finds the garden,
mm-hmm.
and she is so, like, excited about it and starts getting interested in plants, and then asks Martha where she might get
seeds.
Some, like, gardening tools and seeds. Yeah. So do you want to talk about the next character?
I love Dickon so much. He is my favorite character. Dickon is this kind of magical fairy of a child.
magic. It's a big plot
magic,
point.
Yes. He is Martha's little brother. So they both come from this family of like 12 or 13 kids.
I think it's 14.
Yeah. And I think Dickon is maybe one of the youngest in the family.
He's 12. Yeah. Mary and Colin are like 11.
Yeah. But his whole deal is that he's very in touch with nature, and I think largely the explanation given is that he spends so much time outside observing things that he behaves in a way that makes the animals trust him. So he's got, like, a pet crow and a pet lamb that was abandoned and a fox and all these two squirrels.
Yeah.
So he's got all these different animals. He's very in touch with nature. And so Martha directs Mary to Dickon, and Mary's immediately very, very interested in Dickon, even before she meets him.
She's like, ooh.
Yeah. I think it's kind of so novel to her.
Yeah, because she's never really, like, interacted with any other children, let alone any other, like, males, probably.
Yeah.
Besides, like, her father, maybe.
And she doesn't and some know anything about nature, and she kind of wants to learn.
Mm-hmm.
So, Dickon brings her the gardening tools and the seeds, and I love the way he treats her, because he's clearly thinks she's kind of weird, but he's just like, you know what? Whatever.
So they start building up the garden. She brings him into the garden mm-hmm. and tells him to keep the secret. Of course he's going to keep the secret, because he's Dickon. Of course he's going to keep it.
You can trust Dickon.
and everybody says that. Literally everybody in the
Everyone
book.
Loves like, Dickon.
Yes, everybody loves him. He's a good kid.
He's a good boy.
Good boy. He's a good boy. so they start working together in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not long after that that Mary does discover Colin. So she had heard cries in the night when she had first come to the manor. And she'd also, like, explored a little bit.
Yeah.
But
and everyone
never really made it far.
Told her that it wasn't someone crying. Like, everyone, Martha,
just,
everyone was very insistent that it was just the wind wuthering.
So she... It's raining one day. She can't go outside.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, well, it's loud. I can go investigate. So she goes and she hears the crying again. And she leaves her room. And because she's not really, like, that's something else that we forgot to mention is, like, they don't really allow her in the beginning to walk around the manor. Like,
yeah.
They basically say, like, you have to stay in your room. Or, like, go outside.
Yeah.
But really, it's just stay in your room.
She has, like a bedroom and a nursery.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah. So, she finds Colin, and at first he thinks she's a ghost, which is really sad. And she thinks he's a ghost because he's, like, frail and he's skinny and nothing to him.
Yeah.
So then she just... They discover each other, and they find each other. And she starts talking to him, and she tells him about this hypothetical secret garden that might exist. Even though she's been there, she kind of hides it from him at first.
Yeah, because she doesn't know if she can trust him.
Yeah, so she tells him about it, he becomes interested, and he's like, so basically he's been kept a secret, mm-hmm. and nobody can talk about him, so that's why nobody, like, told Mary about him, but everybody else knows about him.
Yeah.
So he basically says, like, I want you to come back and talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I will make it happen. And of course it does happen. He makes it happen, and Mary comes back and talks to him, and there are a couple times when he has tantrums, because he, like, people have put it in his head his entire life that he's sick, and he's weak, and he's ill,
and he's going to die.
Yeah, so he has this intense anxiety around himself going to die, and he also believes that his uncle wants him dead, because if he's dead and his father's dead, his uncle can inherit the property.
Yeah.
And his uncle is his doctor. Colin's uncle, not Mary's uncle, Colin's right. uncle is his doctor. So it's like, he has so much anxiety
mm-hmm.
surrounding his life that when he's worried about, like, he potentially might be getting a hunchback like his father, he has this...
He just melts down.
Anxiety attack. Yeah, he has a meltdown, and people don't know what to do, and Mary steps in, and she basically is like, you need to stop whining.
Yeah.
Like, she just puts him in his place and gives him the reality and says, like, lift your shirt up. I'm going to check to see if you have a lump. There's no lump there. And so she's, like, the only one that can do that, because nobody else feels like they can stand up to him, because they feel mm-hmm. like they'll be punished.
Yeah, because he does, standing up to him. Like, have power over the staff yes. of the manor. He is the son of the owner.
Mm-hmm. So Mary also tells Colin about Dickon, and Colin's also immediately, like, enamored
yeah,
with Dickon.
Yeah, everyone loves Dickon.
And, yep, everybody loves Dickon. That's a new show.
Starring Ray Romano.
Yep. That's, yep.
Deborah.
Anyway. she finally, you know, caves in and kind of tells Colin, like, after his meltdown and after everybody's left, she's like, okay, I'm going to tell you the truth. I found the way into the garden. I found it, mm-hmm. like, a couple weeks ago. Like it's been a little bit before I, you know, when I found it. And so they kind of make up this plan that Dickon is going to come visit Colin so he can actually meet him. Mm-hmm. And then after that, they'll take Colin down in his wheelchair, and he'll make sure nobody else is allowed out in the garden. He'll give an order that nobody else is allowed to be out in the garden. So he'll take Colin out in his wheelchair and bring him into the garden, mm-hmm. the secret garden. So they do that, and he almost immediately is, like, amazed by
it. Yeah.
And they start doing this. This is, like, their new practice is doing this. And after a very short time of doing this, Dickon kind of encourages Colin, you know, to stand or take a step.
Mm-hmm.
But Colin still feels weary about it. So they're in the garden one day, and they're kind of excited about it. And Ben Weatherstaff is,
it's like, peeking
over the wall. Yeah. And he's like, oh, what are you doing here? Like, I don't even know how to do his Yorkshire accent.
Yeah, we should mention the Yorkshire.
Yeah, like, it's really, really strong. But he says, the Mamonu doom gentle person, be careful not to tire the soul. Like, it's like, and Mary starts talking in the Yorkshire accent, too, and, like, it's funny. Like, they all do it together, and Colin thinks it's funny,
yeah.
and all the
Martha
staff
thinks
it's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Ben Weatherstaff is peeking over, and he basically, like, yells at them, and it's like, what are you doing in the garden? Get out me swamp. and then they basically are like, come in here, like, right now.
Yeah.
And so they get him to come in, and they kind of, oh, because Colin stands. That's what it mm-hmm. is.
Just
that's
out of sheer stands. Pettiness.
Yes, Colin, because he keeps saying, like, what are you doing with that boy? Like, he's sick, he's weak, and Colin's finally, like, since he's been out and kind of, like...
They've been doing their calisthenics in the garden.
Yeah, he's like, I can stand! And he stood up with Dickon kind of just, like, holding on to him, or you know, him holding on to Dickon. And he stands, and Ben Weatherstaff is, like, taken aback. And so then he comes through the door, and then he's let in on the secret.
Yeah.
And it also, in the meantime, they've been, like, eating a lot of food and sneaking a lot of food and, like, making potatoes in an oven outside
the woods.
Garden. Yeah, in the woods. And, like, eating all that stuff. So they haven't been eating their food, but they're both getting fatter and healthier. And everybody's like, they're not eating their food, but how are they gaining so much weight? Like, everybody in the house, which is funny.
Yeah.
So they're working in the garden, and Colin continues to practice walking. And in the meantime, they also let Mrs. Sowerby in on the secret, mm-hmm. who is Dickon and Martha's mother. Yeah. And she's kind of like, she, there are a couple characters in the book that portray, like, a little bit of, like, a maternal character mm-hmm. for, like, Mary. So it's, like, Martha, and then Mrs., is it, like, Weatherby? Or Medlock. Mrs. Medlock, I'm sorry. But even so, like, Martha and Mrs. Medlock are still characters who, like, have to be around.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, Mrs. Sowerby becomes this character, even though Mary hadn't really met her until closer to the end, she immediately is, like, a maternal figure.
Yeah.
Like, buys Mary a jump rope at the beginning of the book because she's, like, a child needs to be active.
Yeah.
And that's where Mary first, you know, starts to be a little bit active. And Mary is getting healthier, too, as the book is going on. That's kind of something that's, like, the more she's outside, the more she's in the garden, the more she's active, she is getting healthier, mm-hmm. and she's eating more. That's part of the reason why, is because she is more active, she's eating more, and she's getting healthier. Mm-hmm. So they let Miss Sowerby in on the secret, and she comes in, and she loves it. Oh, and it's also, Ben Weatherstaff has also been taking care of the garden
secretly over the years,
tending to it, because he promised Mrs. Craven before she died.
Yeah.
And he really, really cared about her.
But, yeah. My theory about Ben Weatherstaff and Mrs. Craven is that they had a little bit of a thing. And my secondary theory is that Ben Weatherstaff is actually Colin's father. This is based in nothing.
It's just your own, your deep...
But deep, he's so astonished garden. When he sees Colin healthy.
You know what, Michelle? Write The Secret Garden 2. But the prequel.
The Secret Garden 0.5.
See, that could be like a... That could be a writing exercise. Like, write a prequel for, like, a novel that you read mm-hmm. or whatever when you were younger.
Where
that
would Ben be cool. Weatherstaff.
Where Ben Weatherstaff is Colin's father. You can make it work.
I mean, what's Frances Hodgson Burnett going to do about it?
Right? She's dead. Anyway. So, where was I? Okay, so Ben's let in, Miss Sowerby's let into the secret, so they all kind of know. And meanwhile, Colin has been practicing, like, every single day to walk. Mm-hmm. And he's getting stronger, and he can be out of his chair. And he decides, pretty early on, I still want to be walked in my chair. And walked out in my chair. But when I'm in the garden, I'm going to work, and I'm going to do things like how the new me would. He said, I don't want to show everybody I can walk until my father can see mm-hmm. it. So he does that, and then pretty quickly the book wraps up.
It does.
They work in the garden. Yeah, it's like almost immediately. It switches gears. They're in the garden working. Colin, like, we know he can walk and everything, and they continue doing this. And then it switches gears immediately and shows from Mr. Craven's point of view. And it shows him, like, lonely traveling, not happy, mm-hmm. going to all these places, and, like, totally unhappy with his life.
Yep.
And then he has this dream where he's at Misselthwaite Manor. And he, like, hears his wife calling out. And I don't want to get this wrong. I don't know if you have it written down. She's basically calling to him. And she says...
This is in the garden, right?
In the garden. Yeah, it says, how real the dream had been, how wonderful and clear the voice which called back to him in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
That's 272. So then he basically is like, I'm going to try to find the key and I'm going to try to get in because there was some reason I had this dream. So then he immediately goes to the garden and, like, goes to the door and opens the door. And when he opens the door, everybody's working in the garden mm-hmm. and he sees Colin, like, standing strong, basically. They're all there working and he's, like, amazed that Colin's standing. And at this point, Ben Weatherstaff knew that, like, something was gonna happen, so he was, like, drinking, like, with Mrs. Medlock yeah. in the house, and he sees, like, they see them starting to come up the drive, and Ben's just kind of like, oh yeah, look out there, and everybody looks out, and, like, Colin's walking with his father, and everybody's, like, floored.
Yeah.
And then from then on, Colin, like, walks. And that's kind of, like, the end of the book. So it's, like, it comes full circle with Colin, like, getting better and...
Yeah, it ends on this image of Colin and his father walking together.
Yeah, and they've never had a relationship, but now it's, like, they're able to start a relationship.
Which, on the one hand, is very touching. On the other hand, I hate this man. He abandoned his child, essentially.
And he's like, and he didn't even, like, he didn't try to reassure him that, no, you're not dying.
Yeah.
Oops, excuse me. No, you're not dying. You're healthy. You'll be fine.
He basically, like, left him with a nurse to sad around in Europe.
Yep, and that's the same thing that Mary's mother did to her, so I guess their family
It's a lot of absentee parents in this
book. From the same family, yeah. Okay, so...
Good summary.
So that was the summary of the book. So, really, there's not, like... I hate to say, there's not really a lot to talk about with this book. Because some of it is, like... Sorry, I gotta, like, mark off the stuff I already talked about. A lot of it's, like, pretty self-explanatory. But one big thing that, like, you take away from it is that, like... having a positive outlook versus a negative outlook and kind of like ruminating on your sadness versus it taking control of your destiny. So that's something I kind of do, like, as one of the main themes is like this positive outlook versus a negative outlook, and that there's some type of it, like, they use magic as the driving force behind this positive outlook rather than, like, their own gumption, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me how kind of multifaceted the magic is. Because it sort of functions, like, on the one hand as, like, a sort of a more childlike way to talk about God and creation and that kind of stuff. Like, Colin talks about magic as if it's kind of the fabric of the world. And then on the other hand, it is sort of this thing where your thoughts and your words have power, and that's also magic. So choosing to, like, think positive things and say positive things is a type of magic to these kids. Dickon is very magical, according to Colin.
Hey, I mean, everybody's, like, entranced by him even before they meet him.
So I think that's a really
he's an angel boy. I forgot about that.
He is. I think not just like sort of positive attitudes, but also friendship. Is that, I mean,
yes, yeah, because that's like having a support system.
That's such a big thing, is that Mary and Colin are so isolated, and that isolation kind of makes them sick.
Yeah,
and they get better when they have other people in their lives and they start to care about people. And I mean, it really just breaks my heart the way Mary is kind of characterized when she first starts realizing that she's lonely. There's a sentence in chapter 2. She had begun to feel lonely and to think queer thoughts which were new to her. She had begun to wonder why she had never seemed to belong to anyone, even when her father and mother had been alive.
That's so sad.
And it's just like, it's this really kind of profound loneliness that is really tied into not only how unhealthy they are, but how unpleasant they are. Because they have to actually care about other people for people to care about them, essentially.
Yeah, so that's something, that was one. I kind of, like, took into, like, the childhood innocence as well, because it even says that, like, Mary doesn't know that she's, like, quote-unquote disagreeable. She thinks other people are.
Yeah.
Because she, like, doesn't
know. No one's
know.
Ever told her.
Yeah, exactly. She's never been told that she's, like, a brat. Like, nobody's ever put her in her place.
It also cracks me up how Ben Weatherstaff at one point tells her she's ugly, and she's just kind of like, okay. Like, she has no right? positive or negative, like, associations yeah, with how she looks.
He also calls her a wench when he finds her. Like, when they find
her. I love Ben Weatherstaff.
But yeah, so that's kind of, that's like the main thing I took away from mm-hmm. it. Something that like bothers me about it still is that they're like, this like that meme that I sent you or whatever the other day where it's like, if you go outside, it's going to cure all your ailments. But if you're inside, you're ugly. Like, like that's what it seems like to me that like part of it is, but that doesn't count in the support system, yeah. like what you were talking about.
I think that is something that's there. Although it's kind of like a very extreme example. <Yeah. laughs> Like, if you can't ever go outside, that's probably going to make you feel bad.
Something else that's a similar symbol, of course, is the garden itself. Mm-hmm. Is that, the garden, when it's closed, it's dead.
Yeah.
And it's not really, like, somebody's taking care of it, but just barely. Just doing the bare minimum of what they need to do to take care of it. But then when the garden is revealed and people come into the garden together, like, as working together, that's when the garden truly starts to bloom and when it's thriving. And so that's kind of like, it's a parallel
yeah.
to what's happening in Mary and Colin's lives.
And I think that's probably to kind of start to turn toward what this book might be used to teach. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably a pretty accessible symbol, sort of easing mm-hmm. into the concept of symbolism.
Yeah, that's or a good how thing.
Things outside of you can represent things inside of you.
Yeah.
One thing I was really thinking about on this read, because I also have been reading a book about eco-psychology and eco-therapy, which is really interesting. It's a really interesting subject. But I started thinking about kind of the importance of fostering a love of nature in kids, mm-hmm. and that maybe this book would be a good way to demonstrate kind of how nature can benefit a person.
Yeah, especially like, and I hate saying this, and it's like, it's true, I stay inside a lot too when I'm on my phone or right. like playing a game or something, but it's like, nowadays, when kids see the adults in their lives doing this, like staying on their phone, staying on their computer all day and like not going outside, that's kind of how they fall into yeah. it. So it's like, kids can't totally be blamed for just wanting to be on a tablet or a cell phone all day, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
you have to foster those ideas early in their life that being outside is like fun and it's good for you.
Yeah. And also like beyond just being good for you yeah. as an individual, I think it's a really good societal mm-hmm. Thing to sort of foster that love. I have a quote I wanted to read from one of the papers that's in this book about eco-psychology, because it's a collection of papers. This one is called Sacred Geography by Wade Davis.
Isn't Sacred Geography the, like, Satan thing? Sorry. Geometry. That's Sacred Geometry. Anyway, go ahead.
A child who is raised to believe that a mountain is the abode of a protective spirit will think and act differently than a youth who is brought up to believe that a mountain is an inert mass of rock that is ready to be mined. A boy who is raised to revere the coastal forests as the realm of the divine will be different from a Canadian child who is taught to believe that such forests are destined to be logged. The full measure of a culture embraces both the actions of a people and the quality of their aspirations, the nature of the metaphors that propel them onward.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So I think I actually really love all the magic in this book.
Yeah.
And the idea that nature is magical, not just because that's, like, fun and nice, which I think it is fun and nice,
mm-hmm.
but because I think a lot of people might say, like, oh, that's, like, an anti-scientific attitude or whatever. But I think engaging in that kind of metaphorical thinking is actually quite healthy, and it does shift your attitude, and it does make you believe things that are different than if you believe that nature is empty of magic and it has no benefit to you. You're going to behave differently, and you're going to vote differently and approve of different things, mm-hmm. and not really be bothered if the natural landscape where you live is being destroyed.
Yeah. And to touch on like what you were talking, I mean, this whole thing about like society, mm-hmm. It may also encourage, that popped into my head, like reading this with a child or reading it to a child or having a child read it for class, mm-hmm. It might encourage them and like get them interested in like gardening or the environment, like you're talking about, and perhaps maybe they'll want to volunteer, and maybe they'll want to work in a team, like maybe an activity that can be done to go along with this book that's like a practical activity is like maybe you build a garden mm-hmm. outside your classroom, or maybe you send the kids, or maybe you do an activity where
like a nature walk,
everybody gets a nature walk, or they get like, they bring in a pot, or you provide like pots for mm-hmm. them, and then, which I don't want to say teachers buy these things, but you know what I mean? Like
pots are provided to them by someone.
Maybe like PTO or something, but they get pots and they get seeds and they can grow their own plants and watch them grow and kind of work together. And so it might be like a way to, you know, foster those ideals later, like to love the environment, to protect the environment, as well as like doing your part.
Yeah, and especially if they can, like, pick their own seeds and kind of be responsible for taking care of that. I remember, it's really one of my most vivid early school memories is planting a garden, like a class garden, and we grew mm-hmm. really easy things like radishes and some pearl onions, but when they were grown, we had a little day where we ate them all, and it was... Yeah. It was this kind of magical thing for a kid to be like, I made this and now it's food.
Yeah, our fourth graders did that with like potatoes. Mm-hmm. They planted them and then like they ate them and it was like a whole big party that they did.
Yeah.
And they even like came into the media center after and they were so excited and it was like, it was awesome. Yeah. And I love that they come in and share that with us, that they like, you know, like coming in and talk to us and like to talk to us enough that they're like, we made potatoes today and like we grew them ourselves. Yeah. And yeah, it's super cute.
And it's, I think another interesting thing about this book, and something that's talked about a lot in what I've been reading about eco psychology is kind of the difference between wild nature, like wilderness, and then the more kind of tamed nature, like gardens and things like that, and that they both have a role in our lives. They play different parts. And so I think it's really cool that The Secret Garden, it not only has the garden itself, but it has these kind of wild moors.
Yeah, surrounding.
Yeah, and that those have a benefit to Mary's life mm-hmm. too.
So... the value of teaching, you already touched on this, I'm just looking in mm-hmm. my notes. So I have like part of the value of teaching is it'll teach like kindness and caring and compassion and like empathy and friendship, and the benefits of being outside and going outside and how important it is to give children like love and support mm-hmm. when they're young. Something else that we've talked about is this suitable for the classroom? And yeah, I think this is absolutely suitable for the classroom. Yeah. It's really good. And I don't know, in my head, I'm not sure, like, this was not just written for children to read. This was written for children and adults. There are two sides of it. This is written so for adults to see the impact on children mm-hmm. when they're neglected. Mm-hmm. And when they aren't receiving, like, all of the, like, the nutrients and, like, everything that they need. When they're not receiving their basic, like, needs to survive, what happens to a child and how it, like, stunts them and causes them anxiety and all the... But then for a child, it's also, like, you're reading this and seeing this magic and seeing how you can go outside and, like, also experience this magic in the environment. So it's like, I feel like it's written for both children and adults that yeah. they'll get something out of it.
I think even for readers on the younger side, a good lesson could be, you know, maybe it's worth your time to be nice to that other kid who's yeah. kind of unpleasant yeah. or they don't have anyone else to play with. Yeah. Like, yep, who is yep. like Colin in your life?
Yeah, think of somebody who's like you know, obviously don't make that a lesson. Don't make it a lesson. But maybe put that in. Think about somebody who you know. That's kind of like Jacqueline Woodson's book, Each Kindness. Mm. Is what it's called. It's like it's a short book slash poem. And it's basically this girl who comes to school and she's new mm-hmm. and she's like kind of dirty and kind of weird and doesn't really like fit in. And the quote unquote main character, not a protagonist necessarily, but yes, the protagonist. she at first like doesn't know how to react to this girl, but then all of her friends that she's known are kind of putting this girl yeah. down. So then the main character starts putting the girl down, even though the girl just keeps trying to be her friend. So then eventually she's still being mean to the girl, ignoring the girl, doesn't want to hang out with the girl. Well, the girl moves away. And then she doesn't, like, the protagonist doesn't understand why and is kind of like, is this my fault or is it something else? And I mean, it turns out the girl just moved away, but then she kind of regrets not ever being kind to her. That she, like, treated her so terribly and didn't treat her with kindness. And so it's something, it's Each Kindness by Jacqueline Woodson.
Yeah.
So that kind of harkens back to this. That is, like, think about the people around you and think about, like, what you can do
yeah.
to make a positive impact.
And, you know, if someone's acting unpleasant... Sometimes people are just unpleasant, but maybe there's a reason that you could think about.
Sorry, what does it say in the beginning of the book? She is a disagreeable looking child. No, I'm kidding.
Think of a disagreeable looking child that you know.
It's so messed up. Like, I immediately texted Michelle, like, when I started reading it again. I was like, man, they are dunking on Mary at every page.
It's pretty harsh. So I guess, I also would like to talk about sort of quibbles that I have.
Like likes and dislikes.
Yeah. I like this book a lot. I've always been into this kind of very nature-based.
It's very you.
you know, it aligns with my interests. Little House on the Prairie was my favorite book series growing up, and it's different, but it's sort of similar. But there are a few things, as a modern reader that I kind of question when I read this. One is the depiction of British India, and it sort of goes into this much bigger discussion that I don't think it goes way beyond this book, and I don't think we actually can cover it in one episode in a very comprehensive way. But this question of, is it better to just abridge and cut out parts of a book that are potentially hurtful or offensive? Or is it better to leave them in and use that as a launching point for a discussion?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it reminds me of like the Huck Finn Tom Sawyer yeah. debate too. Like that. Yep, that's exactly what it reminds
and
me.
And I think I often tend to fall in the latter camp, but it does have such this big caveat attached of being willing to have the conversation.
Yeah, it's like the same thing that we're probably going to talk about every time is like, as a teacher, what is your place? Right. Like, what is your place? What are you, you know, allowed to really, and permitted to like go over with a student, like depending on their age and depending on your environment, the demographic.
And I think, you know, whether or not, or to what degree the depiction of India is questionable, if you're reading the unabridged version with a child, I think it's a good bit of just historical explanation that you have to do. Because I don't think I would have understood the beginning as a kid unless someone had sat down and kind of laid out the facts.
Yeah, and like, I had read this book when I was young, and I also believe I read the Great Illustrated Classics version. And like, I really didn't remember much about this book. So reading it was kind of like, oh, this is really nice. Like, I remembered that there was, like, a secret garden, and that was pretty much the most I remembered.
I think it's
about
it's a whole different experience reading the
unabridged definitely text. Definitely. So I don't even remember what was in the other one. Like, I don't, like, I'm assuming they don't talk about certain stuff and go through a lot, but you can continue with yours, because I started getting off track. And
well, there's sort of like a couple other things that I don't I don't know if they would be productive conversations that you could have with the age of children that would be reading this book or you would be reading them with, but it's things that I think about as an adult. One is that, and this is pretty universal in British literature, I think, but poverty is very romanticized in terms of Dickens' family. I really had to pause every time that Mrs. Sowerby bought Mary a gift and then was not reimbursed for it.
Well, Mary does eventually. She's like,
she eventually gets it when Mrs. Sowerby starts sending them food. It has some line about Mary eating the food and then feeling like she was stealing it out of the mouths of 14 children.
Yeah.
Which is like, okay, finally she's getting it. But I think...
So it's reflection. Yeah, that's like learning and reflecting.
But there's still this sort of like very pastoral, like poor people are in touch with the earth. I think that comes through a lot with Dickens, even though I adore Dickens to pieces. It's, you know, it's a big kind of trope. And it's one that I think is worth paying attention to.
And it's also kind of like child rearing is for the poor.
Right.
like you don't have to take care of your child if you're wealthy.
Right.
Other people will do it for you. But if you're poor, you need to take care of your child.
And other people's children.
And other people's children, yeah.
And you only get to go home once a month. Isn't that horrifying?
Oh my gosh, yes! I forgot about that.
Gets to go home to her family one day a month, and when she's home, she helps her mother with housework because it needs to be done.
Yeah, she does it for her mom. Yep, because her mom needs a break. So she works, and on her one day off, she goes home and works at home to give her mother a day off. Wow.
The other thing I kind of question as an adult, and I think it's pretty similar to a conversation we had about holes, is this idea that physical health is tied to moral character. And it's not, this is not the most egregious example of it in my mind, because it's not even that Colin is particularly unhealthy or that he has a disability that severely affects his life. It's more that he stays in bed all the time, so his muscles have probably atrophied just because of the way he was raised. And Mary was kind of, I think, pretty malnourished is the sense I was getting. Because
she's very much like, oh, I never ate this much before.
Yeah, she's very malnourished. She's very inactive.
Mm-hmm.
And so it happens at the same time that she starts becoming a better person, and she also starts putting on weight and getting exercise and building up her muscles. But I think it's still something that's a little... it's worth noting that this is kind of a common... It's a common theme, not in children's literature particularly, but in most media that recovery is sort of your one and only goal. And it's like the end of a character arc.
Mm-hmm.
When the reality is that, you know, a lot of people have things that they don't recover from, and they're perfectly fine with that.
Yeah. And there's, like, a fine line, too, between, like... Like what you're saying is turning it into, like, a trope, mm-hmm. and turning it into this thing where it's, like, in order to be X, you must be mm-hmm. Y. And there actually is, like, some physical benefit to being outside.
Right.
You know what I mean? And, like, for me personally... This is just my single, like, anecdotal thing about myself. I've found that the more I've been running a lot more recently, like, I've been kind of slacking for, like, the past, like, since the summer started, basically. But since, like, April, we were running, like, 3 times a week. And when I was running, when I would be running, and, like, it was cathartic for me. And it was getting me out of my head and all the things I was worrying about, the things I was stressed out about. It started to help me cope with those things and find a different way to release, like a healthier way to release it. And so for me, it's like it feels so much better when I go for a walk or when I go outside. So it's like there's a fine line between that saying, if like it is nice to go outside, and saying it's nice to go outside and healthy to go outside, and if you go outside, then you'll look nice and you'll look healthy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like you'll be beautiful if you go outside. Whereas like for me, I'm like, I feel happier and I feel like I'm not as depressed when I'm like outside more and exercising more, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's changing my outer appearance. Like it's like there's this weird fine line, like what, you know.
Although I'm less pale when I spend time outside. It's yeah.
Do you have any more on the gripe and stuff?
No, I think that was probably... this is less of like a... This is more story-based. I do find the ending very abrupt, like we talked about.
It's so quick!
And I think that it hurts a little bit for lack of resolution about Mary. I'm kind of left wondering... what's next for Mary.
Right. Like,
so I think the first time I read this as an adult, it bothered me a little bit that the focus was shifted away from Mary, because this is a book about Mary. She's the protagonist.
Mm-hmm. She finds the garden. Nobody gave a crap about the garden until, like, Mary started talking about it and hyping it up. Like,
and then I think the flip side of that is that there's an interesting lesson here about after you get better and after you sort of learn your lesson and improve yourself and feel happier, then it's your turn to help someone else, like Mary does with Colin.
Giving back.
Like, I think it's pretty interesting that it's not just Mary is sad and sick and angry, and she comes to England, she finds a secret garden, and then she feels better, and the book ends. I think it's a lot more interesting that halfway through the book, when Mary's starting to feel better and be happier, she finds this person who needs her to do what was done for her.
And she even kind of found most of it herself. Mm-hmm. I mean, she did have some of the supporting characters as, like, support, but for the most part she had to do it herself, and she sees somebody who needs it more, and she decides, okay, well, I need to be proactive and take it into my own hands and do this. No, I really like it, and that's one of, like, I have very little dislikes, because it's hard to, you know, it was really just like that comment you know that you were talking about the tropes of healthy is beautiful or whatever, you know. So I really love the evolution of the characters, and the situations that they were in are very real.
Yes.
That, like, I could see this still happening, like, to this day, but in a different sense. Like, I can see
probably not, like, in a gigantic manner.
Not, yeah, no. But it could happen to, you know, diplomats, you know what I mean? Like, children who are children of diplomats who are always gone, or children who, you know, don't really have much. I mean, they obviously focus on the rich and yeah. being, like, neglecting their children.
But anyone who's sort of has a lonely childhood.
Yeah. Yeah, anything. A parent that works mm-hmm. a lot. You know what I mean? If even if you're poor and your parent works a lot and they aren't really around, even if they do have love for you, they may not realize how difficult it is, like, being on your own and how it affects you. They also loved, like, the descriptions of everything. Mm-hmm. Like, the descriptions of the moor.
Yeah.
And how wild it was and untamed, and yet, like, it has this magic ability to, like, cure, you know, like being out on the moor is like, it takes all of the wildness mm-hmm. and puts it into like tameness into you. I don't know, it's like, it's so cool. And I also love the supportive female characters yeah. because it kind of balances out the, you know, absence of like a mm-hmm. mother in anybody's life, except for Mrs. Sowerby, really. But it, for, like, Mary and Colin, both of their mothers are dead, so they don't have anybody, but there are these strong female characters and supportive female characters yeah. that, like, kind of represent that person for them.
Yeah.
So those are kind of, those are the things that I liked, and like I said, there wasn't much dislike.
Yeah.
It's just, like, it's a quick read, even though it took a while to read. It's a relatively quick read, and the story is pretty straightforward, and
yeah,
it's just like a good feel good story. No, not really feel good, you know, it's really sad good
when her parents
you end
died.
Up no I mean they were mean no, but by the end of it, it's like you feel like,
yeah,
oh wow, that was like a really, like, I feel whole, like it makes you feel like
I did. After I finished reading it, I went for a long walk in the rain and just kind of, like, looked.
That's very, very.
I was like, I have to recharge myself.
Guys, and this is why reading is important. Or folks, that's probably a better one to use. This is why reading is important. Because it can make so many connections mm-hmm. for you. And, like, I'm not saying it works for everybody. It's like exercise. It doesn't work for everybody. But for some people, reading is that.
It's your brain exercise. Help you
connect. Yeah.
Emotion yeah. exercise.
Yeah, so I guess that's pretty much it.
Yeah, should we talk about.
Ran shorter than holes.
Other things we've been reading?
We're gonna talk about that. So, yeah. So I've still been bad. I still have read none of the last book I was reading. Mm-hmm. And I did start, I went to the Scholastic Reading Summit in Orlando, and
oh, yeah.
it was awesome and fantastic and wonderful. And I got some really great, like, ideas to bring to school, like making book bags for kids with either donated new books or donated, like, mm-hmm. new books. Because they were kind of emphasizing, which it's hard, you know, to find the money at a school, but they were kind of emphasizing how, like, children who don't have libraries at home normally just get the used copies mm-hmm. of books. They don't ever have anything new for themselves. So I was kind of thinking, we have a lot of books that have been donated, but a lot of them look brand
yeah.
new. And a lot of them are pretty much brand new. So even if we, you know, we do that, or we call for donations of, like, new or brand new books, and make book bags for kids. I know that's going off topic.
No, it's great.
What I'm
though.
Reading, but that's, you know, things like that are what I was bringing back from the conference. But I did start to read this book called, oh, how do I forget these things? When I think it's called it's the Creativity Project is okay. what it's called. And what it is you'd actually really love this. What's funny is, like, I was going to either buy another copy of this book or send you this book when I was done. But then I told my sister about it, and then she was like, I want to read that too. Let me borrow it when you're done. And I was like, okay, well. So what it is, it's a collection of stories by all these different, like, children's authors and young adult mm-hmm. authors. And what happened is, this one media specialist, who's like a more of like a well-known media specialist, he contacted all these authors and said, hey, can you send me two prompts? It was like 45 authors or something. Can you send me two prompts and I'll send those two prompts off to somebody else. And it could be an art prompt. It could, like, or they can respond with art. They could respond with a short story, a poem, like, a sentence, anything. It could be anything that they could respond with, like, a comic, anything. So everybody, like, traded these prompts and did the prompt. They did one prompt. So it's 45 things, like, a collection of things that are done by these authors. And at the end of the book, they have the other, like, 45 that are other writing prompts that, like, they're like, now this is a launching point for you to go off and do these writing prompts. That's really cool. Yeah. So that's why I was like, Michelle would really like this. So
I love prompts. I am all about prompts.
Yeah, but it's the Creativity Project is what it's called. And there were a bunch of, I picked up a couple more books from the summit that were really, really awesome. I haven't read them yet, but they were recommendations by this other librarian. Mm-hmm. His name is John Schumacher, but he goes by Mr. Shu. And he does these book recommendations, and he's just overall awesome and, like, this big ball of energy. And it was a really, really great experience. And maybe once I start reading some of those other ones, I'll probably mention that I caught this at the Scholastic Reading Summit, and you know, it can kind of bring it in. But yeah, so that's what I'm reading, and that's what I've been doing, and that's my life.
Cool.
Send it on home, Michelle. Bring it home.
There's only one really interesting thing I've been reading. It's called Circus Life, Performing and Laboring Under America's Big Top Shows, 1830 to 1920. So it's obviously a nonfiction book. Cool. It's just kind of talking about working conditions in circuses when circuses were really, really popular. And it also kind of talks about the rise and decline of the American circus. So it's just interesting. You know, I learned something new that I didn't know much about, which is fun. It's from the University of Tennessee Press.
That's cool. Yeah. That's awesome.
All right. Well, I believe it's my turn to pick our next book.
Yeah.
So I am going to have to choose something that is now one of my favorite books, not just one of my favorite children's books, but period, one of my favorite books. One of my favorite series, really. It's a whole series, but we're just going to read the first book. And it is Homecoming by Cynthia Voigt. Amazing book.
Homecoming. I have to write that down, because I'm going to have to look for it probably at the library.
It's one that it's a relatively newer book. I think it was published in maybe the 90s. It's part of a series called The Tillerman Cycle, published in 1981. So, somewhat new, but it's just one of those books that really kind of haunted me after I read it, and I thought about it for a long time.
Homecoming. So. Cool. Yeah. All right, so you heard it here, so in a month, potentially when we can record again.
Yes, because
we will have read Homecoming.
I'm moving. Everything's very unsettled for me right now, but I always find time to read, so.
Yeah.
Think it'll be okay.
All right. I'm Summer.
I'm Michelle.
And this has been I've Read That. Bye. Woo. See you next time. Okay.